We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at University of California at Berkeley. And she is a scientist that in her work is very interested in thinking about, trying to understand how babies see the world, what's going on in their brains, how they experience it, how they learn. And she points out that for a long time, generations, in fact, of psychologists and philosophers have believed that babies essentially were defective adults, irrational, egocentric, and unable to think logically. New studies, however, she says, demonstrate that in fact babies and very young children know, observe, explore, imagine, and learn more than we ever would have thought possible. In some ways, she says, they are smarter than adults. Now, what I'm reading here from is a piece that she wrote that was published recently in the New York Times under the headline, "Your Baby is Smarter Than You Think." And you can read much more about the kind of research that she and other people have done if you look for her new book. It's just recently out, so I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. The title is The Philosophical Baby, and the subtitle is What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Farrah, Straus, and Giroux is the publisher of the book. You might also be interested in looking at an earlier book that she co-authored, the book titled The Scientist in the Crib, which, again, tries to take a look at the way that babies interact with the world. And she kind of makes the argument that they're always doing experiments. They're very actively trying to figure out what's going on in the world and how they fit in. And if you're interested, you certainly can look at either of those books. Well, Professor Gopnik, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I should say again, because you were here, and I had intended to find out when. I know it was a few years ago. You were on the campus and gave a talk, and you were nice enough to come into the studio to talk with us at the time when The Scientist in the Crib, I think, was new.
That's right.
And I'm really pleased you could be with us. Well, you know, I think it would be a good place to start, perhaps, to talk in contrast with what now we are learning about babies and what's going on inside their heads, to talk a little bit about what had been for a long time the way that scientists, psychologists, philosophers had thought about babies.
Well, I think you could kind of click through a list of the things that philosophers and psychologists used to think about babies and what we understand now. Psychologists used to think that babies were irrational and illogical. And in fact, it turns out that even very young babies already are very good at being very, very reasonable and logical and making good inferences about the world around them. People used to think that babies and young children were egocentric, that they couldn't take the perspective of another person. And now we're discovering that even very young children and even young babies already understand a lot about how other people feel and think. We used to think that babies were amoral, that they didn't have any notion of morality until, some people thought, until they were adolescents. And now we're discovering that even very young babies already have capacities for empathy and altruism and understand a lot about the moral nature of the world. Mm-hmm. We used to think that babies were restricted to their immediate sensations and perceptions. They couldn't think abstractly. And now we realize that even very young babies already understand very abstract things about the world around them and the people around them. And finally, philosophers used to think, some of them still think, that babies weren't conscious, or at least that their consciousness was much very restricted compared to adult consciousness. And so dramatically that at one point in the past, they would do operations on newborn babies without giving them anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And I think we started to realize, although this is more speculative, that babies are not only conscious, but in some ways they're even more conscious than we are.
In the sense, and I think that that's a very interesting point. I think in the following sense, One of the things that you argue is that if you look at adults and you look at the way that we make our way through the world, we, and perhaps understandably, are very focused on what we're doing. That is, in a sense, we have narrowed down the focus of our attention and the parts of our brain that are focused on what we're doing. The difference between the adult and the child is that the child is much more, say, wide open, taking in more kinds of information, different kinds of information, much more open to the total environment, and has not yet done this sort of pragmatic narrowing of the focus that adults do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the argument. And that seems to happen in two ways. One thing is that babies just seem to be just generally designed to learn rather than to act and produce and to do things out in the world. In fact, one of the puzzles that we have is, why do we have babies and children at all? Why are our young so dependent on us and so helpless for so long? And in fact, human babies are helpless for much longer than the babies of any other species. And the answer seems to be that a creature like us that depends a lot on learning about the world needs to have this early protective period when all they have to do is learn. They don't actually have to do anything yet. So you get these kind of paradoxical babies who are brilliant learners, you know, can learn four languages at once but can't tie their shoes. On the other hand, as you get older, you have to take all the things that you've learned and put them to use and act. So babies seem to be just designed to be learners. But the other side of that is that there's a kind of intrinsic trade-off between learning and being flexible and being able to do something new and focusing and doing what you do effectively and swiftly and well. And it's almost inevitable that as you get to be better and better and better at doing what you can do, those habits are going to be more and more ingrained, and it'll be harder and harder for you to switch and do something else.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that seems to me to be an important point, and it goes to this sort of contrast between how it is we're thinking now and how it is we thought in the past. It seemed that in the past also, as people thought about how babies were learning about the world, it seemed to be very passive in the sense that they were just like a big empty bucket and stuff was poured into it. And I think that what you and a lot of other researchers are saying is, no, that's not right, is that for babies, this is a very active process. They are actively engaged in exploring the environment, learning about it, doing what you would call little experiments. And it's not the fact that they're just sitting there and the world is writing on the blank slate, as we used to say.
That's right. And, you know, people sometimes say, use metaphors like the blank slate, which was what the great philosopher John Locke said, or people will say, well, babies are like sponges. But that's not really the right description. In fact, we've discovered that even the youngest babies, even literally newborn babies, already have a lot of ideas about the world, including pretty abstract ideas about the world and other people. But in addition to knowing a lot about the world from the time they're very young, babies have these incredible learning mechanisms that are designed to let them actively make sense out of the evidence that they get from the world, let them actively make sense about what's going on in the world around them. And if you look at babies play, babies playing, which we just kind of take for granted, actually seems to be a way of doing things to the world that will let them learn. Babies are almost literally, you know, hungry for learning the way they're hungry for food, and they'll go out and try and do everything they can to make sense out of the world around them.
Mm. Do you think that it is the case, you talked about how babies, they know things that we didn't realize before that they did. And so that suggests that there are some things we don't know exactly how, but, you know, to use the modern phrase, they're pre-programmed into the brain of the baby that they're just there. Is that what we think's going on?
Well, what we think is going on is really two things. So the first thing I think that we discovered was when we started discovering that babies knew so much in the science was to say, well, maybe this is programmed in the way someone like a Noam Chomsky or Steve Pinker would think that language was just programmed in.
Uh-huh.
But what we've discovered more recently, just in the past 10 years, and I think this is really exciting, is that what's also programmed in are mechanisms for learning all sorts of new things that aren't programmed in at all. So it's as if babies, like scientists, never start out just from a blank. They start out with, say, theories about what the world's like. But they also start out with these very, very impressive capacities to alter and revise and change what it is that they think about the world. So both those things go together. Babies are born with a lot in their heads. They're not empty at all. But that very fact means that they can figure out all sorts of brand new things, things that no human being has ever known before, just by using their natural learning abilities.
And that starts right away.
That starts right away. So we have some really remarkable evidence in the past 10 years or so, for instance, that even very young babies are already sort of doing statistics. They're paying attention to the statistical patterns in the world around them, the way that two noises go together, or the way that one event leads to another event. Let me give you an example from some work by a colleague of mine now named Fei Xu. And she did a study where babies were looking at big boxes full of ping pong balls. And the baby saw a box that was mostly red ping pong balls, but with some white ones, so 80% red and 20% white. And then the baby saw an experimenter take some balls out of the box. And sometimes the experimenter took 4 red and 1 white balls out. That was sort of what you'd expect. But sometimes she took 4 white ones and 1 red one out, which is not what you would expect statistically. And the babies looked much longer at the experimenter when she did the unexpected, the less likely, less probable thing, than when she did the more likely, more probable thing. So that meant that these babies who were only 8 months old already could figure out something about what was likely to happen. They could already work something out about the statistics of the world. Even more impressively, she did the same experiment with slightly older babies, and then when she asked the babies to give the experimenter either a red ball or a white ball, they would give the experimenter, and the experimenter had done the unexpected thing. It was as if the babies were figuring, why would she take mostly white balls out of a mostly red box? And they would actually give her the white ball. They seemed to have figured out, oh, what that means is that, as strange as it seems, she must like the white balls more than the red balls. So not only could the babies see and figure out and compute the statistics, but they could actually use them, just like a scientist does, to figure out what was going on in somebody else's head.
Yeah. I think this is very interesting because one of the things that it says is that you can learn a lot by careful observation if you construct the experiment the right way. And I not very long ago, I talked with someone here at the university who has been doing this kind of research, and we talked about this sort of classic thing where you have a baby and you show them a teddy bear and then you put a box over it. And apparently the idea for a long time was that they will believe, because they can't see it, that it doesn't exist anymore. Well,
right.
What she and other people have argued and said, well, that's not right. That baby's not stupid. They know that it's under the box and that you can actually construct what, you know, if you find a way to sneak it out from under there that they don't see, and then you pull it up and it's not there, they do a classic double take as if to say, wait a minute, there was something. I know that was there. You're not fooled. What are you pulling on here? What are you pulling on me here?
Right, but it's also this is Rene Baierjohn's work.
Yes,
he's a great developmental psychologist at the University of Illinois. But that's true. But it's also true that when you watch babies, so they seem to start out knowing something about, for instance, the way that objects appear and disappear. But as you watch, their knowledge and understanding of that gets to be more and more sophisticated. So, for instance, if you do an experiment where they see a large object being covered by a small object, will they predict that the large object's going to stick out?
Yeah,
and that's something that it develops more gradually. So babies do start out knowing a lot, but they also seem to have these capacities to learn a lot at the same time.
And again, I think that they're the kind of concepts that you would think, well, a child would have to be older to get that. Well, no, they will get that. Even quite young babies, they'll get that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because these are quite abstract concepts. It's not just that they're learning this is red and this is blue, or this is sweet and this is salty. They're learning quite abstract things like that objects continue to exist, or that people have particular kinds of feelings. So one of the things that we know that babies and young children are learning about the most is how other people work. And we've discovered that over the course of the first 3 or 4 years, babies are gradually developing a more and more complicated idea about how it is that people work. But from very, very early on, even from the time they're born, they already have some ideas about what's going on inside of other people's heads. Another very abstract idea that we used to think babies only developed much later.
Well, I have several callers here. Let's talk with them, see what questions they might have. We'll start out with someone in Charleston, and this was line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two short questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
The first is some of the language I've heard the guest speaker use seems really similar to Piaget's language. So my question would be, how much does that her work follow from, and then how much does it diverge from Piaget, especially with this idea of the little scientists and the schemes that they might use to understand their world? The second question follows off that small discussion you guys had earlier about this possibility that we're born with some innate knowledge of the world. So my question is, have you been able to establish which concepts may be innate? And I think of the philosophers like Kant, who tried to argue that we were born with things like causality, quality, quantity, some of these basic fundamental concepts or principles of the world. Are there any signs that, or indications that any one of those or others may be innate? Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Those are both fantastic questions. First of all, about Piaget, I think you know, everyone in the field agrees that Piaget was the great originator of this whole field of development. And when you look at what he did, and by the way, when you say he, it was actually his wife, Valentin, who contributed a lot to this work as well. It's amazing that they could have seen as much as they did just looking at babies and young children. And Piaget's big, broad theoretical idea is the idea that babies are active learners, that they construct the world, that they're like little scientists. I think all those ideas are the same kind of ideas that we've developed now. But Piaget was, understandably, since he was, you know, working 70 years ago, understandably turned out to be wrong about a lot of the details of what he thought were going on in children. And in general, he tended, even Piaget, underestimated how sophisticated children's minds were. So, as I say, he thought that babies and children were egocentric and restricted to their immediate sensory motor experience. And it turns out that actually children are even more sophisticated than Piaget thought. So most of what Piaget said empirically, a lot of what he said about babies has turned out to be wrong. But the big general inspirational ideas that children construct and figure out the world around them, I think that's still very true. And what we've really started to do is figure out how to take those ideas and figure them out in detail with our modern, more sophisticated scientific methods. So Piaget is still the great inspiration, but like all great inspirations, the sign of a good scientist is that other people come along and prove that he's wrong. Then in terms of the second question, that's a fantastic question, and I don't think we have a good answer to it. It's a really hard question to answer. If you ask me, my guess is that some basic ideas like the link between patterns of probability and causality are there innately. Probably ideas about objects are there innately. There's probably some basic ideas about people, like, for instance, the fact that people are like us. Newborn babies imitate facial expressions. So if you smile at the baby will smile at you. And that might indicate that this very basic idea that we're like other people are there to begin with. But I think it's important to say that one of the fantastic things about these human learning abilities is that we can overturn even things that we start out with. And that makes it kind of different from what people like Kant thought. So we might start out thinking, oh, people are like me. Other people feel the same way I do. But then when we look around us, we can figure out, oh, okay, they sort of feel the same way that I do, but sometimes they don't. Or we might start out thinking, oh, well, when one object bumps into another, the second object will move. But then we find out about all the exceptions to that. So we do start out knowing a lot, but we can revise and change and alter our view of the world with the same kind of mechanisms. And I think that's a very optimistic picture about how human knowledge works. One of the things that we started to do in the last 10 years is we've been collaborating with computer scientists who are trying to figure out how you could get computers to learn the way that babies learn. And what we're starting to do is actually work out not just are there programs there to begin with, but what's the details about what those programs can do. And the computer scientists are discovering lots of techniques that let us start out one place and end up someplace that's really, really different. A metaphor that I like to use a lot is there was a great philosopher named Otto Neurath, and he said that knowledge was a boat that we build as we sail in it, like Ulysses' boat. And I think that's a good description of what the babies are doing. They start out in the boat of understanding the world, but then they tinker and they change this spar and they can alter this other part of it. And you might end up with something that looks really different from where you started. Hmm.
See, I think, again, that's something that's really, it's sort of staggering when you think about just how much flexibility, plasticity, ability to learn the baby has because, you know, to continue the metaphor, it's they continue to rebuild the boat. It's and to very dramatically come up with a completely new, or maybe not completely new, but substantially new model of the world and how it works, and be doing that maybe every couple of months. That's a remarkable thing.
Yeah, well, as I say, when I talk about babies being smarter than we are, you know, as a scientist, if I have what people sometimes call, you know, you get a paradigm shift every 20 years, and a good scientist might get a new idea every 10 years, and then you feel, my goodness, that's a really great creative scientist. We very blithely, as developmental psychologists, say, oh, well, here's what the baby thinks when they're 18 months old, and here's what they think when they're 20 months old, and then you think, wait a minute, that's only 2 months to completely change your view about how the world works.
Yeah.
So babies are showing this ability for plasticity and flexibility and change that's very deep. And there's another point to make about that, which is the great thing about us human beings is not only that we can learn all of these amazing new things about our environment, and in science we can end up learning, you know, amazing things like quarks and quantum theory, but the other thing about us is that we actually change the world. It's not just that we learn new things about it, but we use what we've learned to actually make the world different from the way it was before, and especially the social world. So we can imagine alternatives to the way the world is now, and then we can actually go out and make them be true. So that imaginative ability, that ability to say, all right, let's think about a different way the world could be, and now we're actually going to make it be that way, that's a very distinctive human ability. So that requires you to have this kind of flexibility to think in new ways. I sometimes say if you just look around the world or look around the room that you're in, you know, look at the right-angled table and the light bulb and the chairs, everything in that room is imaginary from the perspective of someone who is a hunter-gatherer in the Pleistocene. Everything in that room started out as something that wasn't really there, just something that was in somebody's head. So to live and flourish in a world like that, you have to be very good at revising and changing and altering your picture of the world.
This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and the guest this morning is Alison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley. She's the co-author of the book The Scientist in the Crib and author of a brand new book that is titled The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life, published by Farrer, Straus, and Giroux. We have some other callers, and we will talk next with someone in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, interesting, David. I had 3 things. The first would be if your guest understands or buys into the development, she has not said so far at what part of the 3 parts that the baby begins to develop in infancy. And then that enlarges, you know, into childhood and then on to the other 3. Of adolescents and young adults and then older adults. And the use of dialectic in the process, which that's all through nature, just as she's not a plasticine period, you either get smart or you're not around very long in the what we call the savage world, which, you know, are other species and such. And I'll ring off with reference Not long ago, you, David, had a program, and this gentleman articulated the psychological costs of learning to kill. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I was astounded by that and how this man articulated the process. But your guest has some earlier perspective, I'm sure, but there is an example of the evolution of the learning process. And I'll ring off. Thanks.
Well, I think in terms of these big stages, I mean, of course, the development's different in different babies and children, but there does seem to be a point of difference between, say, before children are about 5 or 6 and afterwards. And across cultures, you know, in our culture, we send children to school then, but across cultures, people seem to recognize that children are starting to learn in a somewhat different way when they get to be, you know, 5 or 6 years old compared to what they do as babies and infants. And I think that may be the point where we start to get this transition from a creature that's primarily designed to just learn and be flexible to a creature that's designed to start learning how to do things well, start learning the particular skills and talents of his particular culture. So I think that's a kind of inflection point. And in terms of your second point, I talk a lot in the book about the development of morality in a moral sense. And one of the things that I think is really striking and seems quite plausible is that even very young children have a kind of instinctive reluctance to cause harm to others. That even very young children, even 14-month-olds, will help someone who seems to be in trouble, and even in terms of brain response, seem to respond with distress when they see someone else in distress. Interestingly, the one exception to this, sort of painful exception, is if you look at adults who are diagnosed with as psychopaths, they don't seem to show this kind of response. So I think it's a really interesting question about, you know, you think about awful cases like people being trained to kill, but, you know, if you even think about someone like doctors, I think it's actually interestingly very, very difficult, and a good thing that it's very difficult to cause harm even when that harm is necessary. And that seems to be something that's built into children from a very, very early age.
All right. Let's go next to Champagne, another caller. This is line number 3. Hello.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to have you discuss how this understanding should affect the way we go about child rearing. And related to that, I'm wondering if you're familiar with, one, the Harlem Baby College Project, something that was recently rebroadcast on This American Life, and also if you're familiar with the work of Joseph Chilton Pierce. And specifically, I'm thinking about his book, The Biology of Transcendence and the Blueprint of a Human Experience, and what he has to say about how our enculturation and child rearing affects our later development, and in fact, why we're not able to fully realize the capabilities that come online when the prefrontal cortex, the last part of the brain, fully develops, why we don't have complete access to what's available there. And what he states about that is that that's very much affected by how we are raised from infancy.
Well, it's a good question. A question people always ask is, you know, well, here's all this philosophical philosophy and science about young children. What does that tell us about the question about what, you know, what we should do, how we should raise our babies? And I say sometimes, you know, in a way, the advice that comes out is kind of boring. It's that you should pay attention to your babies and love them, and that they need a rich environment with lots of people who are caring for them, lots of everyday objects that they can play with and explore and find out about. I think one thing that it does say is that this billion-dollar industry of quote-unquote educational toys and Baby Einstein tapes and enrichments is a waste of time and money. But on the other hand, we spend lots of money on that, but we don't spend money to provide children with a very basic thing, which is an attentive caregiver. Our 20% of American children grow up in poverty, and we don't do anything to support parents and other people who are just there taking care of children. So something like the Harlem Project and other projects like the Perry Preschools in Chicago are good examples of the way that just giving children an opportunity to have caregivers who are paying attention to them, to have, you know, a bean plant and a goldfish and wooden bowls and a mom and a grandfather and an uncle and a couple of older siblings who care about you. That seems to be what babies are and children are designed to need. And it's a bit painful that in the richest country in the world, we seem to have such a hard time giving them that.
Well, in the richest country in the world, we're way behind a lot of other countries in terms of giving parents time to be with their children.
Exactly. I mean, we have Europeans are just shocked when they find out that we don't have parental leave, for example, so that someone could take time off to be with their babies when they're young. We don't have publicly funded childcare or early childhood education. I always say, you know, I'm really pleased that my state spends millions of dollars on educating people between the ages of 18 and 21 because that pays my salary. But I can tell you that you learn an awful lot less between 18 and 21, maybe one millionth as much as you do between 0 and 5. And we don't do anything to support the learning of children between 0 and 5.
Thank you. You know, I think one of the things that when I see babies and they are sitting up and they're looking around at the world, I think sometimes the thing that tickles me is you see this expression on their face that seems to be saying, I cannot believe what I am seeing. You know, and again, I think I'm sure one of the questions that people ask all the time is, you know, you think about this state, what the baby must be experiencing, seeing the world, seeing things for the first time, or seeing them with fresh eyes, or being very, very wide open to taking in all of the stimulus that's there. And people, I'm sure people say, if we could only, if maybe only for a little time, get back to that point, to be able as adults to see the world and experience it with that degree of openness, that would be a great thing. Is that something that's actually do you think it's possible to recapture?
Well, I don't think we can ever recapture it quite the way that the babies are experiencing it, and it's probably a good thing because, you know, remember, those are the same babies who are not tying their shoes and dribbling and have to be taken care of all the time.
Right.
But I do think that a lot of the most satisfying adult activities are things like play. Now, there's a reason why babies and children play all the time. And I think when adults are playing and being playful, they can recapture some of that sense of wonder. Another example that I give is when you travel to a new place, you get to have that wonderful feeling, especially a place that's really sort of interesting and different, like going to Beijing for the first time. You have this sense of just being overwhelmed with new sensations and new feelings and new information. And it's as if your consciousness opens up. You remember more from those 3 days in Beijing than you do from months of, you know, zombie going to work and driving and doing the kinds of things that we usually do. So I think there are ways for grown-ups to recapture some of that openness. Now, it has to be said that, of course, when you do that, just like the babies, you wake up crying at 3 o'clock in the morning. So so there's a kind of trade-off. I think part of the reason that babies sleep so much and probably part of the reason why many babies, for instance, start getting so fussy at the end of the day is just because they've been taking in so much at once. But I would do always want to say that one of the best ways of recapturing that experience is to hang out with babies and young children. And I think one of the really wonderful and unsung things about being a caregiver is that you get to simultaneously do the most grown-up thing in the world, which is take care of the young. That's one of the things that's most deeply part of our job as adult human beings. And you also get to be with them and recreate some of that sense of wonder. I talk about when my son was young, we used to go, you know, to the 7-Eleven on the corner to get milk, and I realized I had never seen the three blocks between my house and the 7-Eleven. I had no idea what was there. And when I went for a walk with him, I suddenly realized, my goodness, these three blocks are full of gates and dogs and pizza flyers and manhole covers. Now, it did, of course, take me about 10 times as long to get there, but it was a very rich experience.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe more like 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Allison Kopnik. She's professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley. If you'd like to read more of the kind of things we're talking about here, look for her new book. It's titled The Philosophical Baby, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We have some other callers, and next we will talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wish you'd go back to a question that was posed by one of the earlier callers. He asked several other questions, and it seems to me this question wasn't fully addressed. What is the psychological cost of training for killing, and how does Army training affect the individual and society, and what is the cost of war?
Well, I'm not
just that. I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on this at all, so I can't really address that. I can't address that question directly. What I can say is that when we look at babies and young children, the interesting thing is that we see the roots of both the good and the evil that we see in adulthood. So I like to emphasize the fact that babies turn out to be empathic and altruistic literally from the time they're 14 or 15 months old. They're already responding to distress with distress, and they're already trying to help people. But it's also true that 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds show some of the capacities that lead to things like war. So you already see children, for instance, reacting to what looks like a threat with aggression themselves. So, for instance, aggressive preschoolers are more likely to think that someone else is being aggressive to them than non-aggressive preschoolers. And by the time children are 3 or 4, you already see them dividing people up into us and them. They already seem to be sensitive to the idea, oh, okay, these are the people who are like me, and these are the people who are not like me, and I don't want to spend as much time with the people who are not like me. So I think some of the basic mechanisms that end up leading to things like war, like our instinct to react to threat with anger and aggression, or our instinct to dehumanize an out-group, people who we think aren't like us, we see some of those things early on in development, too. So that's the good news and the bad news. But the final piece of good news is that even very young children already seem to recognize that we can make moral rules, that we can have ways of functioning that will help us to have more good help in the world and less harm in the world. One of the really striking findings is that 3-year-olds, for instance, already distinguish between intrinsically moral activities like not hurting someone and conventional rules like dropping your clothes on the floor of the cubby.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Normal. They are the next, and this is line two.
Oh, hello? Great. Yeah. Good day. Excellent program. Man, I love you guys. But I think, well, first of all, like that one caller talked about, you know, the training of war and all that stuff. You know, I was in the military, and, you know, and my colleagues I go work with in the evenings here in town, you know, they're younger than I am, and they've had some friends of theirs who are just, you know, fresh out of Iraq and stuff. And I tell you, it's not cool. You know, reading a manual, going through the training exercises is one thing, but when you're actually out there in the trenches and you got to pull the trigger, you know, the knowledge versus the reality are two completely separate different things. I mean, you can go ahead and get the training for it and stuff, but once you actually go out there and do it, it's very destructive. And there's, well, in the, you know, I got some people in my family who are like, you know, lawyers, you know, and they end up, you know, they get in trouble and they do it. And they do. They come back and they've got some issues. They do. They need some help with it. I just wanted to say that. I mean, training for killing is one thing, but doing it's completely something else, you know. But also, too, several years ago, I worked at the Hilton in Springfield, and one of my colleagues, she was an immigrant from Russia, and we had just had our first baby at the time, my wife and I. And I was trying to get to where I was working the schedule because she was a student. She was a master's student in grad school, and I was, you know, just trying to get a day to where it's like, oh, if we get it worked out, we don't need to have daycare. And then, but my colleague there, you know, Victoria, she was from Russia, and she's like, oh, this is so crazy, you know, and she had this outrageous Russian accent, you know, and she said that over there they had 3 years of maternity leave, a year and a half of which was paid, because they considered it inhumane to have the child separated from the parents at such for the first 3 years of development. And then the fathers actually had 6 months of paid paternity leave to make sure that they form these crucial bonds. So I was just wondering if anybody has noticed or documented any differences on emotional development, intellectual development perhaps, between Americans versus Europeans who've actually got these. I almost cried when I heard that because I was just trying to get friggin' Monday off, and they were causing me grief to no end, just trying to get Monday off. And then she's like, "Oh, Michael, if you lived over in Russia, you would be fine." It's like, "Oh, give me a plane ticket. I'm there. I'm going. Why are you here?"
There's no question that other countries do a much better job than we do of supporting early childhood development. And I think it's important to say, you know, independently of how is this going to affect the children, caregiving is just an incredibly important, deep, fundamental part of human nature. And just the fact that we don't support caregivers is a big problem by itself. The fact that caregivers, want to spend time with their babies and we make it so hard for them to do it, that's just a problematic all by itself. I gave a talk once at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and it was an international audience. And this was when we had just managed to pass the idea that you should even have unpaid leave. And they said, "Well, it can't be that you've just had all these struggles to pass unpaid leave. Why, of course, what you mean is that you're trying to give people paid leave." And they literally wouldn't believe me when I said, no, we're struggling even to just give people a chance to take an unpaid leave from work. So I think there's no doubt that that other countries do a much, much better job of supporting early childhood than we have in the past. So I hope that's changing, and I think it's a good example of something that really can unite people from lots of different political stripes and with lots of different cultural views. So states like Georgia are starting to realize how important having good early childhood and good things like good leave policies actually are. But it's a struggle.
I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left, about five, and I have one other caller. I want to make sure we can get him in. And they are someone who is in Champaign, so we'll go right there, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I something to note, I studied Japan, and as of 1992, maternity and paternity leave has been given 25% pay for all Japanese people. So that's just to note, even in Asia, that's how it is. One thing I wanted to ask you about was bilingualism. My wife and I speak Japanese at home, and one thing I'm wondering, we don't have any children as of yet, but I'm curious as to the debate, how that's working these days for the very, very young. In other words, in terms of their capacity for being learning bilingually. Also, I do know that in my own experience, I've met a number of folks who spoke perfect Japanese and perfect English, and one fellow, his father was a linguist, and he grew up in Japan, but his father would only speak English to him, and he spoke perfect English. He'd never been to the States till he was an adult, so I was really shocked. But I'm just curious your views on the capacity of children for bilingual.
Often we don't have very much practical to say as scientists, but this is one where I think the situation is absolutely clear, and we can say things really strongly. All the evidence is that learning more than one language does nothing but good. It makes you learn both languages better, and there's actually even some evidence that it helps in other areas of cognitive development.
Uh-huh.
And the evidence is very clear that you can learn a language if you're exposed to it early on much better than later on.
Mm-hmm.
So it drives me a little nuts that, you know, we only start teaching people second language when they hit high school, which is exactly when they're not going to be as good at learning it.
Exactly,
So the evidence, and I'm again, this is one of those things where you have to be sort of shocked that people are discouraging bilingualism. Every bit of empirical evidence is that children are designed to learn more than one language, and it does nothing but good on all fronts.
Great. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I appreciate that.
All right. Very good. We'll go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I'm a lifelong early childhood education educator, and your program has been just so inspiring. But I just have one comment for the person who was looking for child care. If you think we're having trouble getting national health care, if this government ever tried to get national child care, there would be more conservatives coming out of the woodwork than you can imagine. And our profession has been trying for over 40 years, and we're still not there yet. We're better than we were, but we're not there yet. So I just wanted to make that comment.
All right. Thank
you. Well, as I say, you know, my hope is that this is a set of two things. One of them is my hope is that the more the science gets out into the world, the more it will have an influence on people like legislators. And my other hope is that this is something where you ought to be able to have unity across political boundaries. I mean, after all, everybody cares about families. That's something that everyone thinks is important. And if you could get a kind of unity to say that families and young children are just important to everybody, and that supporting families and young children is important to everybody, maybe we could actually get legislators to pay some attention. I mean, part of the trouble is, of course, babies don't vote and moms are too busy to vote and too busy to be politicians. But maybe as more and more politicians hear from more and more moms, that will slowly, slowly, slowly change.
Yeah. And we talked earlier about the fact that there are some people who do all kinds of things and there are programs for parents to try to provide enriched environments for their children and to accelerate their learning and their creativity and all that kind of stuff, which may not be bad, but may be of marginal benefit. At the same time, I know that you're very interested in and very much a booster of early childhood education, and that, in fact, having those kinds of opportunities for children, that's a really good thing.
Well, we've worked very hard at Berkeley to try to establish early childhood education centers that are going to be a model for the rest of the state and the country. And I wanted to say to the person who called, I know that people have been working incredibly hard for 40 years and doing fantastic and wonderful work. And I think a lot of the people who have been involved with babies and young children have intuitively known what we're starting to prove scientifically, how much learning is going on, how much that learning depends on play and interaction. Another really important point and a big worry is that as we go to, say, universal preschool, people will say, oh, that needs to be more like school. We should have reading drills and we should get rid of pretend play, which is something that you already see happening with things like some of the No Child Left Behind guidelines. It's really important that when we have early childhood education, that it's something that will give children the chance to play and interact with other people and learn the way they do best, not something that tries to recreate school for babies and young children.
You know, I can imagine that some people at some point in the past would have looked at the kinds of questions that interest you, questions about the mind of the baby and what she experiences and is there consciousness and so forth. And they might say, well, those are interesting questions, and yet there's no point in asking them because there's no way to answer them. Well, now, in fact, actually, more and more, we do have ways to answer the questions. But then there might still be that ultimate question, why is it important? What about the kind of answers that we have gotten and will continue to get are really makes it an important field of study?
Well, of course, there are all the practical things that we've already talked about. After all, raising children is literally one of the most important things that human beings ever do. You know, it's a cliche to say children are our future, but it's a cliche that's literally true. But I do think there's another dimension, which is that sometimes we get so caught up in the practical part that we don't realize that all of us who have children around are witnessing one of the greatest phenomena in the whole world, something that's truly amazing. And you know, I think it's a little like when you go out to the stars, you look up at them and you say, oh, they're awesome. And then you read about astronomy and you say, oh, my God, they really are awesome. And I think the same thing's true with children. We sort of look at children and then we casually say, gee, that's amazing. But when we actually study them, as when we do any kind of science, we realize, my goodness, they're even more amazing and phenomenal and terrific than we thought. And I think that's really fundamentally what science always does for us.
Yeah, and there is, just real quick to try to make the connection between their experience, and that is between the baby experience, the child experience, and the adult experience. Does it somehow tell us more about who we are as adults, maybe who we are as a species?
I think it does. I mean, one of the things that's most fundamental about us as a species is, in fact, exactly the fact that we have this long childhood and that we have the corollary, which is that we're caregivers. And I think that we have increasing evidence that that shapes our human nature as much as anything else about us, and that other things that we might not have thought were connected to children or caregiving, like our ability to have new technology, our ability to imagine things about the world, our ability to do science, that's all part of one package. And the fact that we have children and that we take care of children and that we were children really plays a crucial role in making us human.
We will have to stop there because we have come to the end of the time. But for people who are listening, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you could look for the book that we have talked about here. I mentioned it a couple of times. The title is The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's just out by our guest, Allison Gopnik. She is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and also the co-author of the book, The Scientist in the Crib. And Professor Gopnik, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much. Those were such wonderful questions.